So my weekend was spent raking leaves and finishing what should have been done in the fall before the snows hit.
Don't put that shovel away yet.
That's what I understand. Come on. Let's hope that doesn't happen.
3 inches tomorrow night.
No, come on. Not going to happen.
What do you think the likelihood of it really happening?
I think it's very good.
Oh.
I hope not. I really hope not.
Well, it's April. Come on. Got to have a little snow.
Well, it is April. You never know what you're going to get in April, right?
No.
In Michigan. And most people finish wearing their winter clothes if they haven't gotten them finished, which I would be one of those people.
There you go.
So. Think of a silver lining. That's it.
Yeah, if there is a silver lining.
If there is a silver lining. Well, anyhow, so, you know, I had a couple of interesting questions this week, and so we thought we'd talk about them. And one of them was we had a landlord who had a tenant die in the apartment, and I know Bill has talked about this before in the past. And, you know, what do you do when somebody dies in a property that's owned by somebody else? How does the owner deal with that? Any hot tips, Bill?
Yeah, I thought we were going to talk about co-ownership more than that. But, yeah, what happens is hopefully the person who was the tenant who passes away has heirs, son, daughter, whatever it may be, somebody who steps up to the bar and takes over, hopefully, well, not necessarily files a probate estate, because one does not always have to be filed. So it presents a problem for the landlord. There is a statute. Hold on. Let me see if I can locate that quickly. Give me just a second. What do I do with that?
You
said
me.
Okay, no, I just pulled up. There is another subject we need to talk about next week, because March 22nd there was a change with respect to, and an extension with respect to, the CDC restrictions against evicting a tenant. But there is a statutory process, and I'm sorry I had that statute someplace fairly readily available. Here we go. Okay. Yeah, there is a statute. It's MCL 600. That's, MCL stands for Michigan Compiled Laws. 600.2918. And there's a subsection in there. Get a load of this. It's subsection 3, small letter D, Romanet. That's small letter I, small letter V, Romanet 4B. 600.2918, sub 3, sub D, sub Romanet 4, sub B. Which is a statute that provides for the landlord to re-enter, take possession of the premises, and dispose of the contents in the leased premises after 10 days have elapsed from the date of a notice, which the landlord posts on the door. The difficulty is that a landlord is prohibited from entering the leased premises by virtue of a statute without the consent of the tenant, or unless the lease provides for entry upon emergency or inspection upon notice, et cetera. But there is this section, says it, this section amended the what's called the Forcible Entry and Detainer Act to provide a mechanism for a landlord to get around that claim of unlawful interference in the event of a tenant's death. However, okay, in order for a landlord to do this, the landlord must have informed a tenant in writing. This is when the tenant's alive, obviously. The landlord must have informed the tenant in writing of the tenant's option to provide contact information for an authorized person. The owner is the contact in the event of the tenant's death. Okay? So that's the first requirement. So you have to do this in advance. You can't just simply upon the death of a tenant, if you haven't had the tenant provide that that contact information in writing, you can kiss this statute goodbye. So every landlord should, in fact, be asking a tenant, for the contact person in the event the tenant dies. Now understand, if there are two people, well, even with two people in there, you know, if it's a husband and a wife, and let's suppose they die in a common accident, now all of a sudden you have a property where the landlord can't go in unless is either probate estate, in which there's a personal representative that the landlord can then deal with, or the tenants have given this contact information. Second, current rent has not been paid. If the rent's been paid, tenant dies, can't do anything until the rent has gone default. Three, landlord believes in good faith that the tenant has been dead for at least 18 days and that there is no surviving tenant. In other words, if they're co-tenants, if one tenant dies, that's irrelevant. This statute doesn't apply. The surviving tenant is still liable. And then item number four, a probate estate has not been opened. If all four of those conditions have been met, then the landlord can post a notice on the door. And after posting that notice, 10 days later, the landlord can re-enter the premises and take possession. Now, understand that the statute says that the landlord must make a reasonable attempt to contact the authorized person to request the person to open a probate estate within 28 days after the tenant's death. So you also have to do that. If there is somebody, see if they will open a probate estate so that you've got somebody that is now responsible. The notice of intent has to be placed 10 days before entering, and the landlord must also notify the public administrator for the county in which the property is located that the tenant is deceased and that the landlord intends to take possession of the premises if a probate estate is not open. So all of these things have to be done. I suspect there aren't many landlords who actually, in the first place, get the contact information or who understand what these requirements are. But there is a statute that allows a landlord to deal with a property where the tenant is now deceased. Does that help you?
Yeah, I don't think we get the contact, so I've just made a note to have Jackie revise our lease. And I'm assuming that doesn't mean the person has to be dead in the apartment for 18 days. That would be kind of sad, wouldn't it?
No. Not in the apartment. Let's hope that doesn't happen. Okay? No. So, yeah. So that's how you deal with it. But unfortunately, I think you're right. I thought that our leases did have a section for contact information. I couldn't remember.
Not for emergency purposes. I'm pretty sure it doesn't. But thank you for giving us that information, and I will make that adjustment.
Hey, so I live to serve.
You do. And the next, I'd ask if there were any questions, but since it's a radio show, we wouldn't have any. So the next topic we were going to talk about that I had a question on is, if I own a piece of property, and let's say I own a piece of property in the city of Jackson, and my daughter lives there, now all of a sudden it's considered a non-owner occupied, even though she's my daughter. And but if I give her, let's say I give her 1% interest in the property, I quit claim deeds 1%, I own 99%. What kind of liability do I have if I do that? Because now it's owner occupied, right? So the requirement for the non-owner occupied goes away. But and that's kind of easy. But what about any liability that might be associated with that? Can she go put a lien against the property? Because she has now 1% ownership in it?
The answer is no. She can't get a mortgage because the mortgage company is going to do a title search, and the title search will reveal that there are two owners of the property. The fact that you only own 1% is irrelevant as far as the mortgage company is concerned. It needs the signatory on the mortgage and probably on the note as well. Understand that there are two things here. There's a debt, which is the mortgage debt, but then there's also the mortgage. And so the mortgage company may, in some circumstances, they may, usually it's where the parent is the guarantor, where they just sign the mortgage, or they sign the mortgage and not the note, where they own the property. But in that circumstance, you're going to have to sign the note, and both of you are going to sign the note, and both of you are going to sign the mortgage. That would be the typical way that a mortgage lender would handle it. Now, okay. As far as the non-owner occupied ordinance, you know that better than I, but I believe that having a 1% interest is sufficient as long as that 1%er is living in the property. The other thing is the homestead exemption. I believe, and you sort of popped this question on me. We didn't talk about it yesterday. Mm-hmm. But I believe that she's also entitled to the homestead exemption. I want to double check on that because having only a 1%, I just can't remember if the statute requires that it be a higher percent. I just don't know off the top of my head.
Well, I'll write a note. I'm trying to get into a new system to be better organized that you will check into that 1% or anything less than 100% ownership. Well, if I'm going to do that.
I know it's less than 100%. That's not the issue, right. But I can't remember whether or not it's 50% or some percent. I don't believe there is a required percent as long as one of the co-owners occupies the property as his or her residence. The other part might be I don't know if there's a proration of the homestead exemption. I just would want to check that out before I said for certain that this is the case.
Okay. Well, I just wrote a note to remind us that we'll readdress that next week. What about liability as far as slip and fall or anything like that?
All right. I want to back up a little bit, and we can talk about slip and fall at some point. But I'm here to tell you that the liability which a property owner has for slip and fall, trip and fall, accidents on the property is very, very small in the state of Michigan. And I'll explain why. Why don't you make a note and we can talk about the liability for bad things that happen on your property next week. But the liability is very low. And then second of all, you as a homeowner carry insurance on your house, which is not only casualty insurance, but it's also liability insurance in the event that someone gets on your property. Also, if your dog bites somebody or injures somebody, although just as a side note, you as a homeowner, you need to check your insurance policy and with your insurance company because some breeds of dogs are excluded from the homeowner's liability coverage. So just be aware of that. So the liability is low. Second, you get insurance. But third, now all of a sudden, if in fact there is liability, it's not all covered by insurance. Now as a co-owner, you are equally liable. It's joint and several liability. Even though you only hold 1%, you are a co-owner with your daughter. And it's not the liability isn't divided out 99% to her and 1% to you. It's divided out joint and several, which means they can go after you entirely. If your daughter doesn't have any assets and you have assets, then the person who's injured and the damages are not covered by insurance can go after you. That's what joint and several is. Now, if you have to pay off entirely, then you get to get you can sue for contribution. You can sue your daughter for contribution for the 99% that you had to pay, which between the two of you was her responsibility. Or you can sue for 49% because she's 50% liable. This also highlights the fact that if you are going to own property with someone else other than husband and wife, it could even be joint tenancy, but particularly in tenants in common, where a parent and a child, they own property as tenants in common. I'm here to tell you, or two people buy an investment property, a rental property to hold as tenants in common, as opposed to they'd be better off with an LLC, but if they hold it as tenants in common, you should always have a co-tenancy agreement, a co-ownership agreement that sets forth the rights and responsibilities of parties, and also what happens if one of them wants to get out. That's one of the other things. And then also what happens in the event of death. So those are all things to consider in a co-tenancy agreement.
And
you want to talk about the forms of co-tenancy?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Well, we're two people, two unrelated people own property, or two people who aren't married to each other. Okay, the ways to hold property together would be co-tenants as tenants in common, and let's suppose you each hold a 50% interest. Upon the death of one of the co-tenants, the 50% interest of the now deceased tenant does not go to the other co-tenant. It goes to the deceased tenant's heirs. There is no right of survivorship. So you have to be aware of that. So that's one thing that a co-tenancy agreement provides, typically that the surviving co-tenant has a right to buy the deceased co-tenant's interest, as opposed to having it go to the heirs. So there's no right of survivorship. The interest can be 50-50. They can be 30-70, or in the example you put, 1%, 99%. Co-tenancy can be any percent at all. And that is probably the most common form of co-tenancy agreement for people that don't want to form an LLC or a partnership or a corporation. And as I say, you want a co-tenancy agreement. The other way to hold property, and understand that if you hold it as an LLC, is to hold it as an LLC, a limited liability company. However, where you're holding property in an LLC, there may be some adverse tax consequences, homestead exemption, particularly the homestead exemption does not apply to LLCs. It applies to trusts. It applies to individuals. It applies to, I think it applies to partnerships, but it does not apply to LLCs.
If I put my property, and that was another question I had yesterday, a father is trying to figure out how to title his property so that if something happens to him, the property goes to the son without uncapping.
Yeah, it's an exemption. A transfer from a parent to a child is exempt from uncapping.
But if it goes, what if the child is has some disability? Now, if it goes into a trust, he was told it uncaps if he transfers it into a trust.
Yeah, he might. Yeah, I have to think about this. But a transfer, if you own property individually and you transfer it into a trust in which you are the trustee and you are the sole beneficiary, that's an exempt transfer from uncapping. It won't uncap. If you transfer it to a child, or if you transfer it to a trust in which you are the trustee, but the beneficiary now is your child, you know, I'd have to check that out under the uncapping statute. I don't know the answer off the top of my head, but it would certainly be easy to find out because the exemptions are set forth there. And there are sometimes when we actually have to do two transfers. I actually did a transfer for property to a couple that he owned the property. They got married, and so now he wanted to put it into a trust in which they were both the trustees. Well, I can't transfer it directly into the trust. What I had to do was I had to transfer the property from him to the two of them as husband and wife, which is one exempt a particular provision under the uncap, under the statute that provides for an exemption from uncapping, and then transfer it to a trust where the husband and wife were the trustees. In other words, 100% commonality of ownership. If I had transferred it from him to a trust where they were the two trustees, that would have uncapped because he would only be 50% owner as the beneficiary of the trust that was set up. So you just have to be careful in terms of how you set up. But I'd want to check that out. I believe there's an exemption for individuals with a disability, but I just don't know off the top of my head. Good question. Why don't you jot that down, and I'll look that one up for you.
I did. I put uncapping statute. I'm so proud of my system. Now I just have to follow through.
Yeah. Okay. And then, so what does he want? In other words, why does he want, he wants his son to get it when he dies, or what is he thinking of?
Yeah.
But his son is disabled and unable to manage the property?
Correct. Yeah, I mean, and it would probably be somebody like a conservatorship, or somebody would have to come in and just run the money part of it. So,
out of time, Laura.
Well,
oh, all right, guys.
Okay, see you, Greg.
No, All right, if you are interested in buying or selling real estate, you should be thinking real estate. Call Laura Dwyer Schlechte at 517-780-3800.